Chapter 4. Esther Walters. Esther Anderson came out of the supermarket and went towards where she had parked her car. Parking grew more difficult every day, she thought. She collided with somebody, an elderly woman limping a little who was walking towards her. She apologized, and the other woman made an exclamation.
"Why, indeed, it's Mrs. Walters, isn't it? Esther Walters?"
"You don't remember me, I expect. Jane Marple. We met in the hotel in Saint-Honoré, oh, quite a long time ago, a year and a half."
"Miss Marple?"
"So it is, of course. Fancy seeing you. How very nice to see you. I'm lunching with some friends near here, but I have to pass back through Alton later. Will you be at home this afternoon? I should so like to have a nice chat with you. It's so nice to see an old friend."
"Yes, of course. Any time after 3 o'clock."
The engagement was ratified. "Old Jane Marple," said Esther Anderson, smiling to herself. "Fancy her turning up. I thought she'd died a long time ago." Miss Marple rang the bell of Winslow Lodge at 3:30 precisely. Esther opened the door to her and brought her in. Miss Marple sat down in the chair indicated to her, fluttering a little in the restless manner that she adopted when slightly flustered, or at any rate when she was seeming to be slightly flustered. In this case it was misleading, since things had happened exactly as she had hoped they would happen.
"It's so nice to see you," she said to Esther. "So very nice to see you again. You know, I do think things are so very odd in this world. You hope you'll meet people again, and you're quite sure you will, and then time passes, and suddenly it's all such a surprise."
"And then," said Esther, "one says it's a small world, doesn't one?"
"Yes, indeed. And I think there is something in that. I mean, it does seem a very large world, and the West Indies are such a very long way away from England. Well, I mean, of course, I might have met you anywhere, in London or at Harrods, on a railway station or in a bus. There are so many possibilities."
"Yes, there are a lot of possibilities," said Esther. "I certainly shouldn't have expected to meet you just here, because this isn't really quite your part of the world, is it?"
"No, no, it isn't. Not that you're really so very far from St. Mary Mead, where I live. Actually, I think it's only about 25 miles. But 25 miles in the country when one hasn't got a car, and of course I couldn't afford a car, and anyway, I mean, I can't drive a car, so it wouldn't be much to the point. So one really only does see one's neighbours on the bus route, or else go by a taxi from the village."
"You're looking wonderfully well," said Esther.
"I was just going to say you were looking wonderfully well, my dear. I had no idea you lived in this part of the world."
"I have only done so for a short time, since my marriage, actually."
"Oh, I didn't know. How interesting. I suppose I must have missed it. I always do look down the marriages."
"I've been married 4 or 5 months," said Esther. "My name is Anderson now."
"Mrs. Anderson," said Miss Marple. "Yes, I must try and remember that. And your husband?"
It would be unnatural, she thought, if she did not ask about the husband. Old maids were notoriously inquisitive.
"He's an engineer," said Esther. "He runs the time and motion branch. He is," she hesitated, "a little younger than I am."
"Much better," said Miss Marple immediately.
"Oh, much better, my dear. In these days, men age so much quicker than women. I know it used not to be said so, but actually it's true. I mean, they get more things the matter with them. I think perhaps they worry and work too much, and then they get high blood pressure, or low blood pressure, and sometimes a little heart trouble. They're rather prone to gastric ulcers, too. I don't think we worry so much, you know. I think we're a tougher sex."
"Perhaps we are," said Esther.
She smiled now at Miss Marple, and Miss Marple felt reassured.
The last time she had seen Esther, Esther had looked as though she hated her, and probably she had hated her at that moment. But now,
Well, now perhaps she might even feel slightly grateful. She might have realized that she herself might even have been under a stone slab in a respectable churchyard instead of living a presumably happy life with Mr. Anderson. "You look very well," she said, "and very gay."
"So do you, Miss Marple."
"Well, of course, I am rather older now, and one has so many ailments. I mean, not desperate ones, nothing of that kind, but I mean one has always some kind of rheumatism or some kind of ache and pain somewhere. One's feet are not what one would like feet to be, and there's usually one's back or a shoulder or painful hands. Oh, dear, one shouldn't talk about these things. What a very nice house you have."
"Yes, we haven't been in it very long. We moved in about 4 months ago."
Miss Marple looked round. She had rather thought that that was the case. She thought, too, that when they had moved in on quite a handsome scale. The furniture was expensive. It was comfortable. Comfortable and just this side of luxury. Good curtains, good covers, no particular artistic taste displayed, but then she would not have expected that. She thought she knew the reason for this appearance of prosperity. She thought it had come about on the strength of the late Mr. Raphael's handsome legacy to Esther. She was glad to think that Mr. Raphael had not changed his mind. "I expect you saw the notice of Mr. Raphael's death," said Esther, speaking almost as if she knew what was in Miss Marple's mind.
"Yes. Yes, indeed I did. It was about a month ago now, wasn't it? I was so sorry. Very distressed, really. Although, well, I suppose one knew. He almost admitted it himself, didn't he? He hinted several times that it wouldn't be very long. I think he was quite a brave man about it all, don't you?"
"Yes. He was a very brave man, and a very kind one, really," said Esther.
"He told me, you know, when I first worked for him, that he was going to give me a very good salary, but that I would have to save out of it, because I needn't expect to have anything more from him. Well, I certainly didn't expect to have anything more from him. He was very much a man of his word, wasn't he? But, apparently, he changed his mind."
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "Yes, I am very glad of that. I thought, perhaps, not that he, of course, said anything, but I wondered."
"He left me a very big legacy," said Esther. "A surprisingly large sum of money. It came as a very great surprise. I could hardly believe it at first."
"I think he wanted it to be a surprise to you. I think he was perhaps that kind of man," said Miss Marple. She added, "Did he leave anything to... oh, what was his name? The man attendant. The nurse attendant.
Oh, you mean Jackson?" "No, he didn't leave anything to Jackson. But I believe he made him some handsome presents in the last year."
"Have you ever seen anything more of Jackson?"
"No. No, I don't think I've met him once since the time out in the islands. He didn't stay with Mr. Raphael after they got back to England. I think he went to Lord somebody who lives in Jersey or Guernsey."
"I would like to have seen Mr. Raphael again," said Miss Marple.
"It seems odd, after we'd all been mixed up so, he and you and I and some others. And then later, when I'd come home, when 6 months had passed, it occurred to me one day how closely associated we had been in our time of stress, and yet how little I really knew about Mr. Raphael. I was thinking it only the other day, after I'd seen the notice of his death. I wished I could know a little more. Where he was born, you know, and his parents, what they were like, whether he had any children or nephews or cousins or any family. I would so like to know."
Esther Anderson smiled slightly. She looked at Miss Marple, and her expression seemed to say, "Yes, I'm sure you always want to know everything of that kind about everyone you meet." But she merely said, "No, there was really only one thing that everyone did know about him."
"That he was very rich," said Miss Marple immediately. "That's what you mean, isn't it? When you know that someone is very rich, somehow, well, you don't ask any more. I mean, you don't ask to know any more. You say, he's very rich, or you say, he's enormously rich, and your voice just goes down a little because it's so impressive, isn't it, when you meet someone who is immensely rich. Esther laughed slightly.
He wasn't married, was he? Asked Miss Marple. He never mentioned a wife.
He lost his wife many years ago, quite soon after they were married, I believe. I believe she was much younger than he was. I think she died of cancer. Very sad.
Had he children?
Oh, yes. Two daughters and a son. One daughter is married and lives in America. The other daughter died young, I believe. I met the American one once. She wasn't at all like her father, rather a quiet, depressed-looking young woman. She added, Mr. Raphael never spoke about the son. I rather think that there had been trouble there. A scandal or something of that kind. I believe he died some years ago. Anyway, his father never mentioned him.
Oh, dear, that was very sad.
I think it happened quite a long time ago. I believe he took off somewhere or other abroad and never came back. Died out there, wherever it was.
Was Mr. Raphael very upset about it?
One wouldn't know with him, said Esther. He was the kind of man who would always decide to cut his losses. If his son turned out to be unsatisfactory, a burden instead of a blessing, I think he would just shrug the whole thing off. Do what was necessary, perhaps, in the way of sending him money for support, but never thinking of him again.
One wonders, said Miss Marple. He never spoke of him or said anything?
If you remember, he was a man who never said anything much about personal feelings or his own life.
No. No, of course not. But I thought perhaps you, having been, well, his secretary for so many years, that he might have confided any troubles to you.
He was not a man for confiding troubles, said Esther, if he had any, which I rather doubt.
He was wedded to his business, one might say.
He was father to his business, and his business was the only kind of son or daughter that he had that mattered, I think. He enjoyed it all. Investment, making money, business coups.
"Call no man happy until he is dead," murmured Miss Marple,
repeating the words in the manner of one pronouncing them as a kind of slogan, which indeed they appeared to be in these days, or so she would have said.
"So, there was nothing especially worrying him, was there, before his death?"
"No. Why should you think so?" Esther sounded surprised.
"Well, I didn't actually think so," said Miss Marple. "I just wondered, because things do worry people more when they are, I won't say getting old, because he really wasn't old, but I mean things worry you more when you are laid up and can't do as much as you did and have to take things easy. Then worries just come into your mind and make themselves felt."
"Yes, I know what you mean," said Esther. "But I don't think Mr. Raphael was like that. Anyway," she added, "I ceased being his secretary some time ago, 2 or 3 months after I met Edmund."
"Ah, yes, your husband.
Mr. Raphael must have been very upset at losing you."
"Oh, I don't think so," said Esther lightly.
"He was not one who would be upset over that sort of thing. He'd immediately get another secretary, which he did. And then if she didn't suit him, he'd just get rid of her with a kindly golden handshake and get somebody else till he found somebody who suited him. He was an intensely sensible man, always."
"Yes, yes, I can see that. Though he could lose his temper very easily."
"Oh, he enjoyed losing his temper," said Esther. "It made a bit of drama for him, I think."
"Drama?" said Miss Marple thoughtfully. "Do you think, I have often wondered, do you think that Mr. Raphael had any particular interest in criminology? The study of it, I mean. He, well, I don't know."
"You mean because of what happened in the Caribbean?" Esther's voice had gone suddenly hard. Miss Marple felt doubtful of going on, and yet she must somehow or other try and get a little helpful knowledge.
"Well, no, not because of that. But afterwards, perhaps he wondered about the psychology of these things,
or he got interested in the cases where justice had not been administered properly, or... Oh, well...
She sounded more scatty every minute.
Why should he take the least interest in anything of that kind? And don't let's talk about that horrible business in Saint-Honoré.
Oh, no, I think you are quite right. I'm sure I'm very sorry. I was just thinking of some of the things that Mr. Raphael sometimes said. Queer turns of phrase sometimes, and I just wondered if he had any theories, you know, about the causes of crime.
His interests were always entirely financial, said Esther shortly. A really clever swindle of a criminal kind might have interested him. Nothing else.
She was looking coldly still at Miss Marple.
I am sorry, said Miss Marple apologetically. I shouldn't have talked about distressing matters that are fortunately past. And I must be getting on my way, she added. I have got my train to catch, and I shall only just have time. Oh, dear, what did I do with my bag? Oh, yes, here it is.
She collected her bag, umbrella, and a few other things, fussing away until the tension had slightly abated. As she went out of the door, she turned to Esther, who was urging her to stay and have a cup of tea.
No, thank you, my dear. I'm so short of time. I'm very pleased to have seen you again, and I do offer my best congratulations and hopes for a very happy life.
I don't suppose you will be taking up any post again now, will you?
Oh, some people do. They find it interesting, they say. They get bored when they have nothing to do. But I think I shall rather enjoy living a life of leisure. I shall enjoy my legacy, too, that Mr. Raphael left me. It was very kind of him, and I think he'd want me, well, to enjoy it, even if I spent it in what he'd think of, perhaps, as a rather silly female way. Expensive clothes and a new hairdo and all that. He'd have thought that sort of thing very silly.
She added suddenly, I was fond of him, you know.
Yes, I was quite fond of him. I think it was because he was a sort of challenge to me. He was difficult to get on with, and therefore I enjoyed managing it.
And managing him?
Well, not quite managing him, but perhaps a little more than he knew I was.
Miss Marple trotted away down the road. She looked back once and waved her hand. Esther Anderson was still standing on the doorstep, and she waved back cheerfully.
I thought this might have been something to do with her, or something she knew about, said Miss Marple to herself. I think I'm wrong. No, I don't think she's concerned in this business, whatever it is, in any way. Oh, dear, I feel Mr. Raphael expected me to be much cleverer than I am being. I think he expected me to put things together. But what things? And what do I do next, I wonder?
She shook her head. She had to think over things very carefully. This business had been, as it were, left to her. Left to her to refuse, to accept, to understand what it was all about. Or not understand anything, but to go forward and hope that some kind of guidance might be given to her. Occasionally she closed her eyes and tried to picture Mr. Raphael's face, sitting in the garden of the hotel in the West Indies in his tropical suit, his bad-tempered, corrugated face, his flashes of occasional humour. What she really wanted to know was what had been in his mind when he worked up this scheme, when he set out to bring it about. To lure her into accepting it, to persuade her to accept it, to, well, perhaps one should say, to bully her into accepting it. The third was much the most likely, knowing Mr. Raphael. And yet, take it that he had wanted something done, and he had chosen her, settled upon her to do it. Why? Because she had suddenly come into his mind? But why should she have come into his mind? She thought back to Mr. Raphael and the things that had occurred at Saint-Honoré. Had perhaps the problem he had been considering at the time of his death sent his mind back to that visit to the West Indies?
Was it in some way connected with someone who had been out there, who had taken part, or been an onlooker there? And was that what had put Miss Marple into his mind? Was there some link or some connection? If not, why should he suddenly think of her? What was it about her that could make her useful to him in any way at all? She was an elderly, rather scatty, quite ordinary person, physically not very strong, mentally not nearly as alert as she used to be. What had been her special qualifications, if any? She couldn't think of any. Could it possibly have been a bit of fun on Mr. Raphael's part? Even if Mr. Raphael had been on the point of death, he might have wanted to have some kind of joke that suited his peculiar sense of humour. She could not deny that Mr. Raphael could quite possibly wish to have a joke even on his deathbed. Some ironical humour of his might be satisfied. "I must," said Miss Marple to herself firmly, "I must have some qualification for something. After all, since Mr. Raphael was no longer in this world, he could not enjoy his joke at first hand. What qualifications had she got? What qualities have I got that could be useful to anyone for anything?" said Miss Marple. She considered herself with proper humility. She was inquisitive. She asked questions. She was the sort of age and type that could be expected to ask questions. That was one point, a possible point. You could send a private detective round to ask questions, or some psychological investigator, but it was true that you could much more easily send an elderly lady with a habit of snooping and being inquisitive, of talking too much, of wanting to find out about things, and it would seem perfectly natural. "An old pussy," said Miss Marple to herself. "Yes, I can see I'm quite recognisable as an old pussy. There are so many old pussies, and they're all so much alike. And, of course, yes, I'm very ordinary. An ordinary, rather scatty old lady. And that, of course, is very good camouflage. Dear me, I wonder if I'm thinking on the right lines. I do sometimes know what people are like. I mean, I know what people are like because they remind me of certain other people I have known, so I know some of their faults and some of their virtues. I know what kind of people they are. There's that." She thought again of Saint-Honoré and the Hotel of the Golden Palm. She had made one attempt to inquire into the possibilities of a link by her visit to Esther Walters. That had been definitely non-productive, Miss Marple decided. There didn't seem any further link leading from there, nothing that would tie up with his request that Miss Marple should busy herself with something the nature of which she still had no idea. "Dear me," said Miss Marple, "what a tiresome man you are, Mr. Raphael." She said it aloud, and there was definite reproach in her voice. Later, however, as she climbed into bed and applied her cosy hot water bottle to the most painful portion of her rheumatic back, she spoke again in what might be taken as a semi-apology. "I've done the best I could," she said. She spoke aloud with the air of addressing one who might easily be in the room. It is true, he might be anywhere. But even then, there might be some telepathic or telephonic communication, and if so, she was going to speak definitely and to the point. "I've done all I could, the best according to my limitations, and I must now leave it up to you." With that, she settled herself more comfortably, stretched out a hand, switched off the electric light, and went to sleep. Chapter 5. Instructions from Beyond. It was some 3 or 4 days later that a communication arrived by the second post. Miss Marple picked up the letter, did what she usually did to letters, turned it over, looked at the stamp, looked at the handwriting, decided that it wasn't a bill, and opened it. It was typewritten. "Dear Miss Marple, by the time you read this, I shall be dead and also buried. not cremated, I'm glad to think. It has always seemed to me unlikely that one would manage to rise up from one's handsome bronze vase full of ashes and haunt anyone if one wanted so to do. Whereas the idea of rising from one's grave and haunting anyone is quite possible. Shall I want to do that? Who knows? I might even want to communicate with you. By now, my solicitors will have communicated with you and will have put a certain proposition before you. I hope you will have accepted it. If you have not accepted it, don't feel in the least remorseful. It will be your choice. This should reach you, if my solicitors have done what they were told to do, and if the posts have done the duty they are expected to perform, on the 11th of the month. In 2 days from now, you will receive a communication from a travel bureau in London. I hope what it proposes will not be distasteful to you. I needn't say more. I want you to have an open mind. Take care of yourself. I think you will manage to do that. You're a very shrewd person. The best of luck, and may your guardian angel be at your side looking after you. You may need one. Your affectionate friend, J.B. Raphael.
2 days, said Miss Marple. She found it difficult to pass the time.
The post office did their duty, and so did the famous houses and gardens of Great Britain. Dear Miss Jane Marple, obeying instructions given us by the late Mr. Raphael, we send you particulars of our tour number 37 of the famous houses and gardens of Great Britain, which starts from London on Thursday next, the 17th. If it should be possible for you to come to our office in London, our Mrs. Sandborn, who is to accompany the tour, will be very glad to give you all particulars and to answer all questions. Our tours last for a period of 2 to 3 weeks. This particular tour, Mr. Raphael thinks, will be particularly acceptable to you, as it will visit a part of England which, as far as he knows, you have not yet visited, and takes in some really very attractive scenery and gardens. He has arranged for you to have the best accommodation and all the luxury available that we can provide. Perhaps you will let us know which day would suit you to visit our office in Berkeley Street? Miss Marple folded up the letter, put it in her bag, noted the telephone number, thought of a few friends whom she knew, rang up two of them, one of whom had been for tours with the famous houses and gardens, and spoke highly of them. The other one had not been personally on a tour, but had friends who had travelled with this particular firm, and who said everything was very well done, though rather expensive, and not too exhausting for the elderly. She then rang up the Berkeley Street number, and said she would call upon them on the following Tuesday. The next day she spoke to Cherry on the subject. "I may be going away, Cherry," she said, "on a tour."
"A tour?" said Cherry. "One of these travel tours? You mean a package tour abroad?"
"Not abroad. In this country," said Miss Marple. "Mainly visiting historic buildings and gardens."
"Do you think it's all right to do that at your age? These things can be very tiring, you know. You have to walk miles sometimes."
"My health is really very good," said Miss Marple, "and I have always heard that in these tours they are careful to provide restful intervals for such people who are not particularly strong."
"Well, be careful of yourself, that's all," said Cherry. "We don't want you falling down with a heart attack, even if you are looking at a particularly sumptuous fountain or something. You're a bit old, you know, to do this sort of thing." "Excuse me saying it, it sounds rude, but I don't like to think of you passing out because you've done too much or anything like that."
"I can take care of myself," said Miss Marple, with some dignity.
"All right, but you just be careful," said Cherry.
Miss Marple packed a suitcase bag, went to London, booked a room at a modest hotel. "Ah, Bertram's Hotel," she thought in her mind. "What a wonderful hotel that was. Oh, dear, I must forget all those things. The St. George is quite a pleasant place."
At the appointed time, she was at Berkeley Street and was shown into the office, where a pleasant woman of about 35 rose to meet her, explained that her name was Mrs. Sanborn and that she would be in personal charge of this particular tour.
"Am I to understand," said Miss Marple, "that this trip is, in my case..."
She hesitated. Mrs. Sanborn, sensing slight embarrassment, said,
"Oh, yes, I ought to have explained perhaps better in the letter we sent you. Mr. Raphael has paid all expenses."
"You do know that he is dead," said Miss Marple.
"Oh, yes, but this was arranged before his death. He mentioned that he was in ill health, but wanted to provide a treat for a very old friend of his, who had not had the opportunity of travelling as much as she could have wished."
2 days later, Miss Marple, carrying her small overnight bag, her new and smart suitcase surrendered to the driver, had boarded a most comfortable and luxurious coach, which was taking a northwesterly route out of London. She was studying the passenger list, which was attached to the inside of a handsome brochure, giving details of the daily itinerary of the coach and various information as to hotels and meals, places to be seen, and occasional alternatives on some days, which, although the fact was not stressed, actually intimated that one choice of itinerary was for the young and active, and that the other choice would be peculiarly suitable for the elderly, those whose feet hurt them, who suffered from arthritis or rheumatism, and who would prefer to sit about and not walk long distances or up too many hills. It was all very tactful and well arranged. Miss Marple read the passenger list and surveyed her fellow passengers. There was no difficulty about doing this, because the other fellow passengers were doing much the same themselves. They were surveying her, amongst others, but nobody, as far as Miss Marple could notice, was taking any particular interest in her. Mrs. Risley Porter, Miss Joanna Crawford, Colonel and Mrs. Walker, Mr. and Mrs. H.T. Butler, Miss Elizabeth Temple, Professor Wanstead, Mr. Richard Jameson, Miss Lumley, Miss Bentham, Mr. Caspar, Miss Cook, Miss Barrow, Mr. Emlyn Price, Miss Jane Marple. There were four elderly ladies. Miss Marple took note of them first, so, as it were, to clear them out of the way. Two were travelling together. Miss Marple put them down as about 70. They could roughly be considered as contemporaries of her own. One of them was very definitely the complaining type, one who would want to have seats at the front of the coach, or else would make a point of having them at the back of the coach, would wish to sit on the sunny side, or could only bear to sit on the shady side, would want more fresh air or less fresh air. They had with them travelling rugs and knitted scarves and quite an assortment of guidebooks. They were slightly crippled and often in pain from feet or backs or knees, but were nevertheless of those whom age and ailments could not prevent from enjoying life while they still had it. Old pussies, but definitely not stay-at-home old pussies. Miss Marple made an entry in the little book she carried. 15 passengers, not including herself or Mrs. Sanborn. And since she had been sent on this coach tour, one at least of those 15 passengers must be of importance in some way, either as a source of information, or someone concerned with the law, or a law case, or it might even be a murderer. A murderer who might have already killed, or one who might be preparing to kill. Anything was possible, Miss Marple thought, with Mr. Raphael. Anyway, she must make notes of these people. On the right-hand page of her notebook, she would note down who might be worthy of attention from Mr. Raphael's point of view, and on the left, she would note down or cross off those who could only be of any interest if they could provide some useful information for her. Information, it might be, that they did not even know they possessed, or rather that, even if they possessed it, they did not know it could possibly be useful to her,
or to Mr. Raphael, or to the law, or to justice with a capital J. At the back of her little book, she might this evening make a note or two as to whether anyone had reminded her of characters she had known in the past at St. Mary Mead and other places. Any similarities might make a useful pointer. It had done so on other occasions. The other two elderly ladies were apparently separate travellers. Both of them were about 60. One was a well-preserved, well-dressed woman of obvious social importance in her own mind, but probably in other people's minds as well. Her voice was loud and dictatorial. She appeared to have in tow a niece, a girl of about 18 or 19, who addressed her as Aunt Geraldine. The niece, Miss Marple noted, was obviously well accustomed to coping with Aunt Geraldine's bossiness. She was a competent girl, as well as being an attractive one. Across the aisle from Miss Marple was a big man with square shoulders and a clumsy-looking body, looking as though he had been carelessly assembled by an ambitious child out of chunky bricks. His face looked as though nature had planned it to be round, but the face had rebelled at this and decided to achieve a square effect by developing a powerful jaw. He had a thick head of greyish hair and enormous bushy eyebrows, which moved up and down to give point to what he was saying. His remarks seemed mainly to come out in a series of barks, as though he was a talkative sheepdog. He shared his seat with a tall, dark foreigner, who moved restlessly in his seat and gesticulated freely. He spoke a most peculiar English, making occasional remarks in French and German. The bulky man seemed quite capable of meeting these onslaughts of foreign language, and shifted obligingly to either French or German. Taking a quick glance at them again, Miss Marple decided that the bushy eyebrows must be Professor Wanstead, and the excitable foreigner was Mr. Caspar. She wondered what it was they were discussing with such animation, but was baffled by the rapidity and force of Mr. Caspar's delivery. The seat in front of them was occupied by the other woman of about 60, a tall woman, possibly over 60, but a woman who would have stood out in a crowd anywhere. She was still a very handsome woman, with dark grey hair coiled high on her head, drawn back from a fine forehead. She had a low, clear, incisive voice. A personality, Miss Marple thought. Someone. Yes, she was decidedly someone. Reminds me, she thought to herself, of Dame Emily Waldron. Dame Emily Waldron had been the principal of an Oxford college and a notable scientist, and Miss Marple, having once met her in her nephew's company, had never quite forgotten her. Miss Marple resumed her survey of the passengers. There were two married couples, one American, middle-aged, amiable, a talkative wife and a placidly agreeing husband. They were obviously dedicated travellers and sightseers. There was also an English middle-aged couple, whom Miss Marple noted down without hesitation as a retired military man and wife. She ticked them off from the list as Colonel and Mrs. Walker. In the seat behind her was a tall, thin man of about 30, with a highly technical vocabulary, clearly an architect. There were also two middle-aged ladies travelling together, rather further up the coach. They were discussing the brochure and deciding what the tour was going to hold for them in the way of attractions. One was dark and thin, and the other was fair and sturdily built, and the latter's face seemed faintly familiar to Miss Marple. She wondered where she had seen or met her before. However, she could not recall the occasion to mind. Possibly someone she had met at a cocktail party, or sat opposite to in a train. There was nothing very special about her to remember. Only one more passenger remained for her to appraise, and this was a young man, possibly of about 19 or 20. He wore the appropriate clothes for his age and sex, tight black jeans, a polo-neck purple sweater, and his head was an outsized rich mop of non-disciplined black hair. He was looking with an air of interest at the bossy woman's niece, and the bossy woman's niece also, Miss Marple thought, was looking with some interest at him. In spite of the preponderance of elderly pussies and middle-aged females, there were at any rate two young people among the passengers. They stopped for lunch at a pleasant riverside hotel, and the afternoon sightseeing was given over to Blenheim. Miss Marple had already visited Blenheim twice before, so she saved her feet by limiting the amount of sightseeing indoors and coming fairly soon to the enjoyment of the gardens and the beautiful view. By the time they arrived at the hotel, where they were to stay the night, the passengers were getting to know each other. The efficient Mrs. Sanborn, still brisk and unwearied by her duties in directing the sightseeing, did her part very well, creating little groups by adding anyone who looked as if they were left out to one or other of them, murmuring, "You must make Colonel Walker describe his garden to you. Such a wonderful collection of fuchsias he has." With such little sentences, she drew people together. Miss Marple was now able to attach names to all the passengers. Bushy eyebrows turned out to be Professor Wanstead, as she had thought, and the foreigner was Mr. Caspar. The bossy woman was Mrs. Risley Porter, and her niece was called Joanna Crawford. The young man with the hair was Emlyn Price, and he and Joanna Crawford appeared to be finding out that certain things in life, such as decided opinions, they had in common on economics, art, general dislikes, politics and such topics. The two eldest pussies graduated naturally to Miss Marple as a kindred elderly pussy. They discussed happily arthritis, rheumatism, diets, new doctors, remedies, both professional, patent, and reminiscences of old wives' treatments, which had had success where all else failed. They discussed the many tours they'd been on to foreign places in Europe, hotels, travel agencies, and finally the county of Somerset, where Miss Lumley and Miss Bentham lived, and where the difficulties of getting suitable gardeners could hardly be believed. The two middle-aged ladies travelling together turned out to be Miss Cook and Miss Barrow. Miss Marple still felt that one of these two, the fair one, Miss Cook, was faintly familiar to her, but she still could not remember where she had seen her before. Probably it was only her fancy. It might also be just fancy, but she could not help feeling that Miss Barrow and Miss Cook appeared to be avoiding her. They seemed rather anxious to move away if she approached. That, of course, might be entirely her imagination. 15 people, one of whom at least must matter in some way. In casual conversation that evening, she introduced the name of Mr. Raphael so as to note if anyone reacted in any way. Nobody did. The handsome woman was identified as Miss Elizabeth Temple, who was the retired headmistress of a famous girls' school. Nobody appeared to Miss Marple likely to be a murderer, except possibly Mr. Caspar, and that was probably foreign prejudice. The thin young man was Richard Jameson, an architect. "Perhaps I shall do better tomorrow," said Miss Marple to herself. Miss Marple went to bed, definitely tired out. Sightseeing was pleasant but exhausting, and trying to study 15 or 16 people at once, and wondering as you did so which of them could possibly be connected with a murder, was even more exhausting. It had a touch of such unreality about it that one could not, Miss Marple felt, take it seriously. These seemed to be all perfectly nice people, the sort of people who go on cruises and on tours and all the rest of it. However, she took another quick and cursory glance at the passenger list, making a few little entries in her notebook. Mrs. Risley Porter, not connected with crime, too social and self-centred. Niece Joanna Crawford, the same, but very efficient.
Mrs. Risley Porter, however, might have information of some kind which Miss Marple might find had a bearing on matters. She must keep on agreeable terms with Mrs. Risley Porter.
Miss Elizabeth Temple. A personality. Interesting.
She did not remind Miss Marple of any murderer she'd ever known.
In fact, said Miss Marple to herself, she really radiates integrity. If she had committed a murder, it would be a very popular murder, perhaps for some noble reason, or for some reason that she thought noble. But that wasn't satisfactory either. Miss Temple, she thought, would always know what she was doing and why she was doing it, and would not have any silly ideas about nobility when merely evil existed.
All the same, said Miss Marple, she's someone, and she just might be a person Mr. Raphael wanted me to meet for some reason. She jotted down these thoughts on the right-hand side of her notebook. She shifted her point of view. She had been considering a possible murderer. What about a prospective victim? Who was a possible victim? No one very likely. Perhaps Mrs. Risley Porter might qualify. Rich, rather disagreeable. The efficient niece might inherit. She and the anarchistic Emlyn Price might combine in the cause of anti-capitalism. Not a very credible idea, but no other feasible murder seemed on offer. Professor Wanstead. An interesting man, she was sure. Kindly, too. Was he a scientist or was he medical? She was not as yet sure, but she put him down on the side of science. She herself knew nothing of science, but it seemed not at all unlikely. Mr. and Mrs. Butler. She wrote them off. Nice Americans. No connection with anyone in the West Indies or anyone she had known. No, she didn't think that the Butlers could be relevant. Richard Jameson. That was the thin architect. Miss Marple didn't see how architecture could come into it, though it might, she supposed. A priest's hole, perhaps. One of the houses they were going to visit might have a priest's hole which would contain a skeleton, and Mr. Jameson, being an architect, would know just where the priest's hole was. He might aid her to discover it, or she might aid him to discover it, and then they would find a body. "Oh, really?" said Miss Marple. "What nonsense I am talking and thinking." Miss Cook and Miss Barrow. A perfectly ordinary pair, and yet she'd certainly seen one of them before. At least, she'd seen Miss Cook before. Oh, well, it would come to her, she supposed. Colonel and Mrs. Walker. Nice people. Retired army folk. Served abroad, mostly. Nice to talk to, but she didn't think there'd be anything for her there. Miss Bentham and Miss Lumley. The elderly pussies. Unlikely to be criminals, but being elderly pussies, they might know plenty of gossip, or have some information, or might make some illuminating remark, even if it happened to come about in connection with rheumatism, arthritis, or patent medicine. Mr. Caspar? Possibly a dangerous character. Very excitable. She would keep him on the list, for the present. Emlyn Price. A student, presumably. Students were very violent. Would Mr. Raphael have sent her on the track of a student? Well, it would depend, perhaps, on what the student had done, or wished to do, or was going to do. A dedicated anarchist, perhaps. Oh, dear, said Miss Marple, suddenly exhausted. I must go to bed. Her feet ached, her back ached, and her mental reactions were not, she thought, at their best. She slept at once. Her sleep was enlivened by several dreams. One where Professor Wanstead's bushy eyebrows fell off, because they were not his own eyebrows, but false ones. As she woke again, her first impression was that which so often follows dreams, a belief that the dream in question had solved everything. Of course, she thought, of course. His eyebrows were false, and that solved the whole thing. He was the criminal. Sadly, it came to her that nothing was solved. Professor Wanstead's eyebrows coming off was of no help at all. Unfortunately, now she was no longer sleepy. She sat up in bed with some determination. She sighed and slipped on her dressing gown, moved from her bed to an upright chair, took a slightly larger notebook from her suitcase, and started work. "The project I have undertaken," she wrote, "is connected certainly with crime of some kind. Mr. Raphael has distinctly stated that in his letter. He said I had a flair for justice, and that necessarily included a flair for crime. So crime is involved, and it is presumably not espionage or fraud or robbery, because such things have never come my way, and I have no connection with such things, or knowledge of them, or special skills. What Mr. Raphael knows of me is only what he knew during the period of time when we were both in Saint-Honoré. We were connected there with a murder. Murders, as reported in the press, have never claimed my attention. I have never read books on criminology as a subject, or really been interested in such a thing. No, it has just happened that I have found myself in the vicinity of murder rather more often than would seem normal. My attention has been directed to murders involving friends or acquaintances. These curious coincidences of connections with special subjects seem to happen to people in life. One of my aunts, I remember, was on 5 occasions shipwrecked, and a friend of mine was what I believe is officially called accident-prone. I know some of her friends refused to ride in a taxi with her. She had been in 4 taxi accidents, and 3 car accidents, and 2 railway accidents. Things like this seem to happen to certain people for no appreciable reason. I do not like to write it down, but it does appear that murders seem to happen, not to me myself, thank goodness, but seem to happen in my vicinity. Miss Marple paused, changed her position, put a cushion in her back, and continued. I must try to make as logical a survey as I can of this project which I have undertaken. My instructions, or my briefing, as naval friends of mine put it, are so far quite inadequate, practically non-existent. So I must ask myself one clear question. What is all this about? Answer, I do not know. Curious and interesting. An odd way for a man like Mr. Raphael to go about things, especially when he was a successful business and financial operator. He wants me to guess, to employ my instinct, to observe, and to obey such directions as are given to me or are hinted to me. So, point one, direction will be given me. Direction from a dead man. Point two, what is involved in my problem is justice, either to set right an injustice or to avenge evil by bringing it to justice. This is in accord with the code word nemesis given to me by Mr. Raphael. After explanations of the principle involved, I received my first factual directive. It was arranged by Mr. Raphael before his death that I was to go on tour number 37 of Famous Houses and Gardens. Why? That is what I have to ask myself. Is it for some geographical or territorial reason? A connection or a clue? Some particular famous house or something involving some particular garden or landscape connected? This seems unlikely. The more likely explanation lies in the people, or one of the people on this particular coach party. None of them is known to me personally, but one of them at least must be connected with the riddle I have to solve. Somebody among our group is connected or concerned with a murder. Somebody has information or a special link with the victim of a crime, or someone personally is himself or herself a murderer. A murderer as yet unsuspected. Miss Marple stopped here suddenly. She nodded her head. She was satisfied now with her analysis so far as it went, and so to bed. Miss Marple added to her notebook, "Here endeth the first day." Chapter 6. Love. The following morning they visited a small Queen Anne manor house. The drive there had not been very long or tiring. It was a very charming-looking house and had an interesting history as well as a very beautiful and unusually laid-out garden. Richard Jameson, the architect, was full of admiration for the structural beauty of the house, and being the kind of young man who is fond of hearing his own voice, he slowed down in nearly every room that they went through, pointing out every special moulding of fireplace and giving historical dates and references. Some of the group, appreciative at first, began to get slightly restive as the somewhat monotonous lecturing went on. Some of them began to edge carefully away and fall behind the party. The local caretaker, who was in charge, was not himself too pleased at having his occupation usurped by one of the sightseers. He made a few efforts to get matters back into his own hands, but Mr. Jameson was unyielding. The caretaker made a last try. "In this room, ladies and gentlemen, the white parlour, folks call it, is where they found a body. A young man it was, stabbed with a dagger, lying on the hearth rug. Way back in 1700 and something it was said that the Lady Moffat of that day had a lover. He came through a small side door and up a steep staircase to this room through a loose panel there was to the left of the fireplace. Sir Richard Moffat, her husband, you see, was said to be across the seas in the Low Countries. But he come home, and in he came unexpectedly and caught 'em there together." He paused proudly. He was pleased at the response from his audience, glad of a respite from the architectural details which they had been having forced down their throats. "Why, isn't that just too romantic, Henry?" said Mrs. Butler in her resonant transatlantic tones. "Why, you know there's quite an atmosphere in this room. I feel it. I certainly can feel it."
"Mamie is very sensitive to atmospheres," said her husband proudly to those around him. "Why, once, when we were in an old house down in Louisiana—"
The narrative of Mamie's special sensitivity got into its swing, and Miss Marple and one or two others seized their opportunity to edge gently out of the room and down the exquisitely moulded staircase to the ground floor. "A friend of mine," said Miss Marple to Miss Cook and Miss Barrow, who were next to her, "had a most nerve-wracking experience only a few years ago. A dead body on their library floor one morning."
"One of the family?" asked Miss Barrow.
"An epileptic fit?"
"Oh, no, it was a murder. A strange girl in evening dress, a blonde, but her hair was dyed. She was really a brunette and—"
"Oh." Miss Marple broke off, her eyes fixed on Miss Cook's yellow hair where it escaped from her headscarf. It had come to her suddenly. She knew why Miss Cook's face was familiar, and she knew where she had seen her before. But when she had seen her then, Miss Cook's hair had been dark, almost black, and now it was bright yellow. Mrs. Risley Porter, coming down the stairs, spoke decisively as she pushed past them and completed the staircase and turned into the hall.
"I really cannot go up and down any more of those stairs," she declared, "and standing around in these rooms is very tiring. I believe the gardens here, although not extensive, are quite celebrated in horticultural circles. I suggest we go there without loss of time. It looks as though it might cloud over before long. I think we shall get rain before morning is out."
The authority with which Mrs. Risley Porter could enforce her remarks had its usual result. All those near at hand, or within hearing, followed her obediently out through the French doors in the dining room into the garden. The gardens had indeed all that Mrs. Risley Porter had claimed for them. She herself took possession firmly of Colonel Walker and set off briskly. Some of the others followed them, others took paths in the opposite direction. Miss Marple herself made a determined beeline for a garden seat, which appeared to be of comfortable proportions, as well as of artistic merit. She sank down on it with relief, and a sigh matching her own was emitted by Miss Elizabeth Temple as she followed Miss Marple and came to sit beside her on the seat.
"Going over houses is always tiring," said Miss Temple. "The most tiring thing in the world, especially if you have to listen to an exhaustive lecture in each room."
"Of course, all that we were told is very interesting," said Miss Marple, rather doubtfully.
"Oh, do you think so?"
said Miss Temple.
Her head turned slightly, and her eyes met those of Miss Marple. Something passed between the two women, a kind of rapport, of understanding tinged with mirth.
"Don't you?" asked Miss Marple.
"No," said Miss Temple.
This time the understanding was definitely established between them. They sat there companionably in silence. Presently, Elizabeth Temple began to talk about gardens, and this garden in particular.
"It was designed by Holman," she said, "somewhere about 1800 or 1798. He died young. A pity. He had great genius."
"It is so sad when anyone dies young," said Miss Marple.
"I wonder," said Elizabeth Temple. She said it in a curious, meditative way.
"But they miss so much," said Miss Marple. "So many things."
"Or escape so much," said Miss Temple.
"Being as old as I am now," said Miss Marple, "I suppose I can't help feeling that early death means missing things."
"And I," said Elizabeth Temple, "having spent nearly all my life amongst the young, look at life as a period in time complete in itself. What did T.S. Eliot say? The moment of the rose and the moment of the yew tree are of equal duration."
Miss Marple said, "I see what you mean. A life of whatever length is a complete experience. But don't you," she hesitated, "ever feel that a life could be incomplete because it has been cut unduly short?"
"Yes, that is so."
Miss Marple said, looking at the flowers near her, "How beautiful peonies are! That long border of them! So proud and yet so beautifully fragile."
Elizabeth Temple turned her head towards her. "Did you come on this trip to see the houses or to see the gardens?" she asked.
"I suppose, really, to see the houses," said Miss Marple. "I shall enjoy the gardens most, though. But the houses, they will be a new experience for me. Their variety and their history, and the beautiful old furniture and the pictures," she added. "A kind friend gave me this trip as a gift. I'm very grateful. I have not seen very many big and famous houses in my life."
"A kind thought," said Miss Temple.
"Do you often go on these sightseeing tours?" asked Miss Marple.
"No, this is not for me exactly a sightseeing tour."
Miss Marple looked at her with interest. She half opened her lips to speak, but refrained from putting a question. Miss Temple smiled at her.
"You wonder why I am here, what my motive is, my reason. Well, why don't you make a guess?"
"Oh, I wouldn't like to do that," said Miss Marple.
"Yes, do so."
Elizabeth Temple was urgent. "It would interest me. Yes, really interest me. Make a guess."
Miss Marple was silent for quite a few moments. Her eyes looked at Elizabeth Temple steadily, ranging over her thoughtfully in her appraisement. She said,
"This is not from what I know about you, or what I have been told about you. I know that you are quite a famous person, and that your school is a very famous one. No, I am only making my guess from what you look like. I should write you down as a pilgrim. You have the look of one who is on a pilgrimage."
There was a silence, and then Elizabeth said, "That describes it very well. Yes, I am on a pilgrimage."
Miss Marple said, after a moment or two, "The friend who sent me on this tour and paid all my expenses is now dead. He was a Mr. Raphael, a very rich man. Did you, by any chance, know him?"
"Jason Raphael? I know him by name, of course. I never knew him personally or met him. He gave a large endowment once to an educational project in which I was interested. I was very grateful. As you say, he was a very wealthy man. I saw the notice of his death in the papers a few weeks ago. So he was an old friend of yours?
No, said Miss Marple. I had met him just over a year ago, abroad, in the West Indies. I never knew much about him, his life or his family or any personal friends that he had. He was a great financier, but otherwise, or so people always said, he was a man who was very reserved about himself. Did you know his family or anyone?
Miss Marple paused. I often wondered, but one does not like to ask questions and seem inquisitive. Elizabeth was silent for a minute. Then she said, I knew a girl once, a girl who had been a pupil of mine at Fallowfield, my school. She was no actual relation to Mr. Raphael, but she was at one time engaged to marry Mr. Raphael's son.
But she didn't marry him? Miss Marple asked.
No.
Why not?
Miss Temple said. One might hope to say, like to say, because she had too much sense. He was not the type of a young man one would want anyone one was fond of to marry. She was a very lovely girl, and a very sweet girl. I don't know why she didn't marry him. Nobody has ever told me. She sighed, and then said, Anyway, she died.
Why did she die? Said Miss Marple.
Elizabeth Temple stared at the peonies for some minutes. When she spoke, she uttered one word. It echoed like the tone of a deep bell, so much so that it was startling.
Love, she said.
Miss Marple queried the word sharply.
Love?
One of the most frightening words there is in the world, said Elizabeth Temple. Again her voice was bitter and tragic. Love.